you were going to say anything. That's why I kind of led you into that.
So we're at Dirt Time 2011 at Lake Silverwood, and I'm at the camp of Al Cornell and Mike Campbell. What do you guys call your camp again?
Ektois.
Ektois, what does that mean?
That's the Ektois is a Mayan god of commerce, and his codec is a guy sitting down, kneeling down with a backpack with all his goods in it, twirling up an ember to start a fire with.
And that's what I see on your tent right there.
Exactly.
Well, why would the Mayan god of commerce be making a fire with a hand drill, by the way? Any idea?
Probably to cook his cacao beans.
Okay, all right.
Keep warm, possibly.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So, where are you from, Mike?
I'm from Cottonwood, Arizona.
And how'd you get into all of the... you guys are both doing all of the fire-making classes,
yeah.
All the different methods, modern to primitive, to make fire. How'd you get into all that?
Well, I met Al Cornell.
Who's sitting right here with us. Hi, Al.
Yep, hi.
I met him when I joined the Search and Rescue Posse in Cottonwood, Arizona. And, we go out on searches and rescue people that are lost or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had an affinity with him. He was a really good a person with a very generous heart and a lot of integrity. So I just kind of was drawn towards him and found out that he had all of these skills, and he had been going to gatherings of people that practiced primitive methods of fire starting and other stuff that were prehistoric.
Uh-huh. Did you learn a lot of these skills from Al?
I learned all of my fire making skills.
Well, that's
from
good.
Al.
That's yeah. That's a good recommendation.
Exactly. Yeah. Al is my primary fire teacher.
Good. Yeah. And so Al, we talked a little bit earlier, but you live in what town?
I live in Sedona, Arizona.
In Sedona, and tell me again how you got started with all of the fire skills.
Well, I've always.
I know you probably you never thought about it like I'm doing the fire skills because everything relates to everything else. But just for the sake of what we're talking about tonight,
specifically for I've always had I'm retired Army,
uh-huh.
And as an Army aviator, I always had an interest in the survival aspect of Army life, of Army assignments. And
did you learn about any of these skills in the Army?
A little bit of it in the Army, and then in 1967, the Army sent me to the Navy Jungle Survival School in the Philippines.
Okay,
and it was at that school where I learned my first prehistoric method of making fire, and that is sawing bamboo onto bamboo.
Okay.
By the local natives known as Aitas.
The Aitas, okay.
And we followed the Aitas all through the jungle, and they taught us all the different skills. But the one that stuck with me, and is really my favorite sentimental fire making method, is the fire saw. I learned it in '67, and here we are over 40 years later, and I'm still doing it. And it's my favorite method because of that it was the first.
Yeah, now, when you say fire saw, that's what you had me do this morning.
That's what I had you do this morning.
Can you try to describe it?
Which you did quite well, by the way.
Well, I mean, I
was stunned how easily you did it.
Well, I didn't know how well I'd do. I mean, I watched you do it, and you seemed to do it easily enough. But then you probably done it hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I told you, later, I went through my mind over and over. Am I going to do this? What are the problems? I've already thought about it, worried about it far longer than I actually did it. But try to describe for somebody who hasn't seen that what we're doing with the bamboo to make fire.
You're splitting a piece of bamboo, and of course it's round and hollow. And what you're doing is you're using half of that split. You cut a notch into it, and on the inside of the notch you put a bunch of tinder.
Okay.
The ember that you're going to form is actually formed from sawing that notch onto the other half of it, on the edge of the other half of it, the other half being like a knife blade,
mm-hmm.
And you're sawing back and forth with this tinder. The ember is actually made from the bamboo itself. It's not made, the tinder is just a place for it to house the ember until you think you have one and start blowing, and there it is.
Yeah. Now, we call it a saw, but I once saw a guy make a piece of bamboo that looked like a saw, and he made a sawing motion.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, in your case,
there's a variety of ways of doing it.
It looks like a cross. It's one's perpendicular,
yeah.
And you're kind of rubbing it back
sort
and forth
like,
really quick.
Sort of like, and in fact, I've seen people actually saw in this method. It's like putting a saw blade between your legs, and taking the wood in your hand and going back and forth on the saw blade.
Right, right.
I have seen people actually saw that using that method to saw in some of our campouts. It's just easier. It was easier for what they were doing to just put their knees and hold onto the saw with their knees and saw the piece of wood with her and just move the wood back and forth instead of moving the saw back and forth.
Yeah.
But there's at least four or five different styles of doing the sawing. And the style you saw today was where you actually kneel above the wood and you use your body weight as you're pressing down and sawing. And the Aitas use that method because they're generally 4 foot 9 to 4 foot 11, maybe, the men. Rarely see one that's 5 foot. And 100 pounds, that's a pretty good size Aita, 100 pounds.
So it's easier to get low to the ground.
They get on top of it, low to the ground, mm-hmm. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, so do you like that method, Mike?
That works for me, but there is no bamboo indigenous to this area.
Oh, okay.
So right. I don't use that very very often.
Plus, you're a big guy. You're not a 5 footer that's 100
exactly,
pounds.
Exactly, right, right.
What's your preferred method?
Well, the first method I learned was the bow drill.
From Al. Yeah.
And that consists of a drill that you drill into, a wooden drill that you drill into another piece of wood. Mm-hmm. And that creates sawdust, and the friction of the drilling gets it hot enough to enter a sustained chain reaction, and it forms an ember like the end of a cigarette.
Right, right.
And then you take that ember that you obtain and drop it into a bundle of combustible material and blow on it and it ignites into flame.
And it seems like that's the most common method that all the survival schools are teaching these days, the bow and the drill.
That is really common because, number one, it's easy.
It's easy,
and just about everyone can do it.
Yeah.
And once you master that one, then you can move on to the other ones.
Yeah.
And number two, everyone has shoelaces.
Oh, yeah,
so
for the
cord. So you need a pocket knife and a shoelace, and you have all the tools you need to do that method.
Right.
That's a very, very excellent survival method. If you're caught out without any matches, you can always take a shoelace off, tie it onto a stick, there's your bow.
What would you suggest if you have these Velcro-type shoes? What's that funny noise? Is that your cell phone?
That's my phone, I'm sorry.
That's no problem.
Well, there's
no
things
problem.
You can take, like the upper lining of your pants.
Okay.
Is as you know, double-stitched, and you could, if you had to, cut that off and use that.
Yeah.
You could strip the bottom of, like a t-shirt, is always doubled and sewn.
I knew a guy that told me he took...
plant materials can be used. I use yucca leaves in the forest and start and use that for the string part of
right.
the bow drill.
Mm-hmm. Now, for anybody who's not done this, a lot of the listeners may have done it, but that cord is under a tremendous amount of pressure. So I always like to use parachute cord when I do it. But your yucca, how long does it last? Do you get a lot of use out of it if you're using a natural
yucca cord?
Yucca cord,
probably, my experience has been good for one fire.
Oh, one fire,
yeah,
okay.
Generally one fire, maybe two at the most.
Yeah.
Because I'm just taking raw yucca. I'm not processing it.
Oh, okay.
I'm just taking a raw yucca leaf, stripping yucca fibers out of it, long, long fibers, and maybe reverse wrapping them into cordage. I've done it without even reverse wrapping them, just taking the long fibers and kind of rolling them into a ply, like, and then just using that. And that's good for one fire. Whereas your shoelaces is probably good for 20 or 30.
Right, before it wears out. Yeah, I had a Marine that came to my classes once, and he wanted to do everything in the woods that day, bow and drill. And I found some rope. I said, hey, this is legitimate. We found it, right, if you're lost. But he wouldn't do it. It all had to be something natural. And he did yucca. Mm. I think he got two fires out of his kit that he made that day. Yeah, I was really
very
happy.
Yeah, right.
I saw you today, Mike, showing people how to use the bow and drill. And you had a whole box of different kind of woods. What are you recommending students use in terms of wood types?
The wood type is going to depend upon your locale.
Okay.
And every locale has good stuff, mediocre stuff,
right.
and stuff that doesn't work.
Right.
In our area, it's kind of ironic because I live in a desert where we don't need fires very often, but we have the prime fire starting materials. And what I like to use is the flowering stock of bear grass or soap tree yucca for my fireboards.
Now, bear grass, that looks sort of like yucca, doesn't it?
It looks very similar to yucca, the leaves are different, the flowers are different.
Okay.
It's a totally different plant.
All right.
But it has nice low density, the flowering stock is a nice low density wood.
Okay.
That that disintegrates easily with a drill system.
And you're using it for the drill or the hearth?
I'm using it for the hearth board.
For the hearth, okay, and interesting.
For the drills, I use a bush called seep willow. It's not a true willow.
Which I call mule fat out here.
Mule fat in California,
yeah. And I noticed you had some, did you say your wife made these little bearing blocks for the top?
Yeah, ceramic
kinda,
bearing blocks.
Those are kind of cool. And you had rocks that when I looked at, now bearing block, for those of you who don't know, you have to hold it with something at the top.
That's what you hold the top of your drill with to keep it from wobbling all over the place.
And you had rocks that it looked like you had drilled a little starter hole in it.
No, I didn't drill those holes.
It was all natural.
All natural. It's rocks that we pick up when we go on our recreational hikes. We keep our eyes open. And that's where we collect our bear grass, where we collect our yucca, where we collect our mule fat.
We
also collect rocks.
They were nice bearing blocks that fit the hand.
Mm-hmm.
In Southern California, on some of the beaches, I'll find rocks like that with little natural depressions.
Right.
And so I began with the bone drill. That was my first method. I think I went to the hand drill after that.
Mm-hmm.
And you were having people do the hand drill too, right? Maybe you could comment
out. Actually, today and yesterday, we were concentrating more on methods that are more reliable. The hand drill, the only way it's really reliable is if you have all your materials with you. It's very difficult to just walk in the woods and cut down a branch.
This
or
is true.
Cut down something
it can
and do
be
a
done.
Hand drill.
Yeah, it's difficult
because you have no way to straighten it. I mean, you don't have fire.
Yeah.
So, but a bow drill, the drill's much shorter, so you can cut your materials right on the spot and make a fire. A hand drill, you know, you need 18 inches or 2 feet of drill.
Right.
Hard to find something like that in the woods. You can, but it's. You're risking your life if you think that's how you're going to start a fire that day.
Yeah.
The hand drill, we've been concentrating more on the bow drill and the Arctic strap drill, another method of twirling a drill but using a strap or a thin piece of leather and a mouthpiece.
Okay.
And it is in a very efficient method, probably developed by the Thule culture. Which was a non-maritime culture in prehistoric Canada,
okay,
probably around 800 to 1200 AD, and the entire kit fits in a small pouch, no larger than 6 to 8 inches, and they wore it inside their caribou hides
against
their chest.
It was developed to be small, to be portable, like that.
Small and portable, and developed to where they took it out and then set it up, and then they put their mittens back on. And would drill the fire with their mittens on.
Uh-huh.
So the strap would have little bones or teeth at each end so that you could grab it with your mittens.
Now,
a very efficient method. It's just as efficient as the bow drill. And we really, we demonstrated that yesterday. Michael did that during our presentation. And we've had just an enormous amount of people yesterday and today coming over and wanting to learn that method because they like the compact quality of it and to go with the efficiency of it. So, and he and I both call it our cordless Bic lighter.
Cordless Bic lighter.
We both keep them in our pockets. We both go hiking and camping with those. And that's how we light our fires.
Is that right?
With the strap drill.
That is actually my favorite method. You asked me earlier what was my favorite method.
Right.
It's actually the Arctic strap drill. As a matter of fact, I have a wood shop in Cottonwood. And in the wintertime, I go out every morning and start a fire in my potbelly stove. I use the Arctic strap drill every day.
It's, well, it keeps you in shape doing
for me,
it, you know?
It's just as easy as lighting a Bic because I practice it.
It seems like when you're up in front of the crowd that it took you, 30 seconds or less to get your
possibly.
Pull?
Sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's slower.
Yeah, now, just for somebody who's never heard of this before, because I've seen pictures of it but really never saw anybody do it before, you've got a bit in your mouth, so instead of the handhold, you've got a block of wood in your mouth,
there's
little block of wood.
Right. There's a block of wood that we hold in our mouth that has a depression in it that holds the top of the drill.
Holds the top of the drill, so your head is over the drill.
Exactly.
You're kneeling down with your head over the drill, which I find a little uncomfortable, but I haven't done it yet, right? I'm going to try it maybe tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a little drill about, 6-7 inches?
It could be variable. If it's a little bit longer, it's easier. You don't have to bend down as far.
But then it's a bigger kit.
Yes.
And the Inuits, having looked at their kits on a trip up north and having seen them actually make a kayak using the same system, they take another drill and put a nail in the end, and that's their cordless drill for drilling holes.
Oh, interesting.
Same thing. Oh, yeah, they'll have two or three drills. One will be for fire, and one will be for drilling holes to lash kayaks, you know, plankings on kayaks.
So they're using a bit in the mouth with a little nail or whatever at the end of the drill.
And they're always about 6 or 8 inches long.
Interesting.
Yeah, they didn't use really long drills. But longer, you don't have to bend over quite as far. So we did a kit for a young man here today that a little bit longer because he had trouble bending over that far. But generally, their drills were not quite a half an inch in diameter. Uh-huh. I mean in width, and 6 to 8 inches long, would be about right.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was relatively small, but then the drill was pretty small too.
And the mouthpiece, a piece of wood, or up there they would use sometimes bone or walrus ivory. It is bitten, you bite on it with your molars.
So you have to kind of work the wood so it fits your mouth comfortably, right?
Yeah, well, there's a certain size it fits well.
Yeah.
If it starts to get too narrow, the drill can touch your teeth, which you don't want.
You don't
and
want it to touch your teeth.
If it's too wide, you can get a gag reflex from it,
uh-huh.
too. So there's sort of an optimum. And we've sort of figured that out. And, we've probably trained 30 people the last 2 days.
Really?
With strap drill.
Really?
Yes. And the drill size we're using birch, which is hard. Harder than all the woods you're drilling with. That's what you want.
That drill is birch that you got. The mouthpiece. Okay.
It's harder than everything else. You don't want smoke coming out your mouth.
Oh, of course.
Burning that wood.
Right, right.
But everyone has done really well with the size mouthpieces we're using now. Everyone.
It's about
has done
a half inch square.
Yeah, I watched a guy do it. I was very impressed.
Yes.
And
ladies are doing it too. I had a number of ladies, and they've all been successful
so
far. In fact, this group here. I don't think I've had any failures this week on the strap drill. They've all done really well.
Let's see. There was one guy who tried repeatedly. I don't know if he got it or not. I'm just trying to remember. But it looked like most of the folks were getting it pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So my maybe irrational fear is that I think the thing is going to go in my eye or my nose. And what did you say about that?
No, because when you're pulling the strap back and forth, you're pulling it left and right. If it pops out, it's going to fly off to the left or off to the right. They're not going to pop up.
Yeah.
The bow drill is actually more dangerous in that regard because you're bowing to and from your body. And when that pops out, it can fly up or hit somebody in front of you.
That's true. The bow drill frequently does pop out.
Yes.
It flips because you have it under all that pressure.
It pops out more than the strap drill because the bow drill is going forward and aft in the way you're facing. And that's where your notch is, where the dust that you're pulverizing from the drilling falls in that notch. Sometimes that notch allows that drill to pop out. With the strap drill, you're doing 90 degrees to that notch. The notch is on the side of the board, and you're going the length of the board with your strap. And
You might convince me. Yeah, I've got to try it.
Oh yeah, no, we'll fix you up tomorrow with a strap drill set and see what you think.
And so for those who've done the bow drill, you have that bowing motion, but instead of the bow, you're just holding onto the string with your fingers, and it actually is very ingenious.
Correct.
Just as long as you keep the tension on both sides straight. So
there is another variation of this that the Athapascans use. That's sort of like central Alaska all the way over to the U-peaks in Siberia, where they actually will use a small bow. In other words, they'll have a mouthpiece, and they'll bend over, and instead of using a strap to make the bow, the spindle or the drill,
right.
They use a small bow, and they will hold with the other hand. They will hold the piece that they're drilling into, so they can do it on someone's back if they bend over. They can do it on a tree stump or on a down tree.
Could do it on their own knee.
They can do it on their knee, and they use a small bow to do the bowing motion.
And we're talking about a bow that's like, what, eight inches or 6 inches?
Small seal rib.
Tiny, yeah.
Generally. They're generally less than 12 inches long, and they have to be small to be compact and carried around inside their clothing. So that's a variation of it. I prefer the Inuit method myself.
Actually, one person today asked this, if we could teach someone how to do the strap drill one-handed.
One-handed? How would you do that?
That's where you come up with
the bow.
You can do it one-handed. You can actually do a fire with one arm or one hand. You could tie the other one behind your back, and what you would do is you'd insert the mouthpiece, then you insert the drill and twist it back up, put it in your mouth, bend forward, and then you start bowing.
And you'd hold the hearth down
with a like a keeper board. Stick.
With a keeper stick, yeah.
It holds the board in place.
It's worth a challenge. I mean, sometimes that's the situation.
Well, we have an acquaintance of ours actually demonstrates that at Winter Count.
Uh-huh.
How do you do a fire with one hand prehistorically? And Michael has another method that's historic, and that is using a metal match. You know, it's sort of like the modern flint and steel, only it's a metal match like you were carrying today.
Right.
And with one hand, start a fire.
How do you do that, Michael?
Well, I take my knife, jam it in the log, put my foot behind it to support it.
Put your foot behind the knife.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Have some tinder in front of my knife.
Okay.
It will catch a spark and ignite.
Okay.
And using my one hand, I pull my metal match across the knife.
Okay. So the knife has to be real secure.
That's why you have to jam it in a log and put your foot behind it to secure it.
Interesting.
But
so
if you have a broken hand or broken arm, you can still start a fire.
Right.
With your metal match.
Right, because
if
a lot
you
of
did not, of course, the solution is a lighter.
Right, carry a lighter, carry a pick.
Yeah. But or a match and something, you know, like hold the matchbox between your knees or something. But this is another way. It's another way of starting a fire with one hand.
That's ingenious. That's ingenious.
And the metal match is something that can be used wet. It can be entirely wet.
True.
Kind of shake the water off it and scratch, and you got sparks.
Oh, same with my magnesium thing.
That's what we're talking about.
Because I think of the metal match as just that rod, but the magnesium at least has the fuel on it.
Well, that'll burn the water.
Normally, when I use your magnesium fire starter, I do not scrape the magnesium off of
just
it.
Just use the sparker.
I just use that magnesium as a good handhold.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. The other one is just a little rod.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
What do you guys think about the Egyptian bow drill?
I think it's pretty clever because it takes a lot of stress off of the cordage.
Okay.
So a piece of cord that has a lot of stress with bow drilling on cordage. So if you were to take a yucca cord and get one fire out of it or two, you could probably get 10 with the Egyptian, because what it does is you have additional wraps around the drill, and what it does is when you're pushing one direction, it's unwinding the other way, and so it's winding and unwinding rather than just solid pressure both directions.
It's very similar to the strap drill in that it has multiple wraps around the drill.
Let's attempt an explanation of the Egyptian bow drill if somebody doesn't know. It looks like a bow and drill, but what's the main difference?
Multiple wraps around the drill with your cordage.
But do you,
and it also has a knot in it.
A knot in it. I've seen guys that put a hole in their drill and run the cord through.
Yeah, so that way when you're pushing one direction, it's unwinding.
Okay.
It's winding up one side and unwinding the other, and then you come back the other way.
So basically your cord is attached to your drill.
With a knot, and there's a knot there, and it's winding one way and unwinding when you come back the other way.
So it would either be tied with a knot or pushed through the hole.
And we know that the Egyptians used it because we've actually found them in tombs, or
there's some in the British Museum of Natural History that go back 6,000 years. They were carbon dated. They found all pieces of it.
And were they the only culture that actually used that particular method?
I don't know. Drilling with a cord has been found from Malaysia and India all the way over to Europe.
Okay, and I'd like to see if I can get your comment on a few other methods. Are you familiar with the thong, where you take a cord and you rub it under a log?
Yes.
Have you ever tried that method?
Yes, I have, and I really had difficulty with it. I think I need someone to really train me on how to do that.
Yeah, because I knew a guy that liked that method, and I never was able to extract the details out of him, like what kind of cord, what kind of wood, how you actually do it.
Well, one person I saw do it was using rattan.
Rattan.
And the pictures I've seen of natives in Borneo that use this method, they were wearing strips of rattan around their waist, and the reason they were carrying the rattan was their fire starting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So there's the thong, there's the bamboo method.
The fire saw or sawing method.
The saw, and then there's the plow that we saw on Castaway.
Which is very Polynesian.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very. Now, did you guys see Castaway?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Remember Tom Hanks could not get a drill?
That's right.
He couldn't do it with a hand drill.
Yes.
And he got it with a plow. That's not realistic,
That's
is it?
That's not realistic, no.
No.
The problem with the fire plow is you're pushing a stick down and making all your sawdust go to the end of the groove in the
stick. Right. You're developing a groove bigger and bigger and bigger and getting smoke.
And that's developing heat as you push it down.
Yeah.
Then you have to pull it back and do it again. When you pull it back, you're cooling off your pile of sawdust.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of effort to get the fire pile to work.
Yeah. It takes twice the effort of a saw, because with a fire saw, you're sawing both directions. You're pushing and you're pulling, and you're pushing and you're
like
pulling.
Like you had me do this
and
morning.
You're sawing, yeah. And you're getting heat both directions. With the plow, you're pushing, but when you come back, that's
it
wasted
cools.
Effort.
Yeah,
and you're pushing and you come back. So it takes twice the effort to do a plow than it does a saw. And the saw takes some effort.
Yeah.
So it's not an efficient method compared to drilling, which every time you push the drill forward or back with a bow, it's drilling.
It's drilling, making
dust.
Right.
With the plow, you make dust one direction only.
Yeah.
And you pull back and then go in a second time and then you pull back, go a third time. Every time you pull back, that's lost motion.
Yeah.
So it's half as efficient as the other method.
Yeah. Lost motion and lost heat. Both.
Yeah. But and yet cultures did do that. I have a friend who was in South Pacific somewhere, and they demonstrated at one of the cultural centers, and he said it was something like balsa wood, and he couldn't do it, but he watched a 10-year-old boy do it who was trained in it. So why would you think that they developed things that way? I mean, they just happened to develop it that way, and yet it was...
Could have been material dependent. A lot of times materials will dictate. I have a plow set from the cultural center in Hawaii, and it's hibiscus.
Oh, really? Hibiscus
wood. It's hibiscus. And,
interesting.
The guy that made the fire on it was a large Samoan, very nutritionally endowed Samoan, and he was able to, you know, crank that out. I've been able to do the fire plow, but it's been on soto, which is a plant. It's related to the yucca and agave family. It's a Dasylirion in southern southeastern Arizona, but it's so much more work than the fire saw.
It's so much
more work. Takes so much more. Practice just to make that plow stop at the same point every time you push it, so you don't knock all that dust you're making all over the place. You have to stop at a certain point each time, and finally there's a point at which it will enter a sustained smolder, and it's a lot of work compared to the other.
And that's really the trick, is getting it to stop at that one point.
Yes.
I've read about it in a lot of books, and I've tried it. I think I got a call once that went out right away, and I was just dead exhausted after trying the plow.
Then you know.
Do you remember another little movie point? Hollywood does what it wants, but in Castaway, remember the point of when Tom Hanks finally succeeded? He was plowing, and all of a sudden there's a flame.
That's not realistic.
No, that's not the way it happens.
No.
Yeah.
No, you. All of these methods give you dust that reaches that rises in temperature and enters what's known as a sustained smolder. And the temperature of a sustained smolder depends on the fineness of the dust, and of course the heat that you're producing. I ran some tests on this, and I wrote an article for the Primitive Skills Bulletin, and I had a number of woods that were giving me sustained smolders. In other words, they entered like the end of a cigarette and burned until all the dust was gone and glowed at temperatures as low as 200 to 220 degrees. And those same woods won't turn to flame until almost 500 degrees.
Interesting. So you got
I called a company that worked with pyrometers, and I asked the guy, what kind of pyrometer would you use for this type of testing? And he said, oh, you're working with woods. And I said, well, I'm concerned because I think I'm going to be below 400. He said, oh, yes, there's a number of woods that when turned to dust will give you temperatures well below 400 to smolder. He said, yes, that's true. There are a number of woods that do that.
Yeah,
and that sort of backed up what I had suspected. And I used thermocouples in the little notch, and we just drilled until we had an ember. And one person was drilling, one person watching the temperature gauge on the pyrometer. And as soon as the ember started to glow, the person drilling would say, I have an ember, and the person on the pyrometer say, 240 degrees or 220 degrees. And... It was just stunning to see how low a temperature certain powders will enter a sustained smolder.
And you had a chart or a graph in the bulletin about this?
Yes, an article about it. Yeah, I tested
What issue was it, or do you remember?
It's been probably 4 years,
five years ago. Well, it only comes out twice a year. It wouldn't be too hard to find.
No.
I keep all the back issues.
Yeah, it was a very interesting study. And when I went to the editor, Dave Westcott, I mentioned that to him, and I said, you know, some people don't agree with that this is possible. And he said, of course I agree. He said, at what temperature does a spontaneous combustion occur at? And I didn't know, so I did some research in that. Spontaneous combustion, that's a sustained smolder of hay, occurs at 185 degrees.
What causes that?
I was stunned. Huh?
What causes spontaneous combustion of hay?
That's a bacteria builds up.
Okay.
You have moisture inside the hay, a bacteria starts to develop, and the bacteria grows in there, and the heat increases. Then it gets up, goes up 150, 160, 170 degrees. The bacteria now dies from the heat, but now the temperature continues to rise on its own.
Interesting. And then the barn burns down?
And at 185, it actually enters a sustained smolder.
I see.
And it just keeps increasing in temperature until it bursts into flame.
I see. So, so a farmer's barn all of a sudden is burning.
And the stats on this came from the Ministry of Agriculture of the Government of Canada. That's where I got all this. Because it's a big problem in Canada with the wheat and hay farmers up there.
You know, a big part of what you're showing people also is to get your get everything ready when you before you start, have your tinder bundle ready. What are some of the can you tell me what are some of the tinders that you're having people use and recommending to use, Mike?
Well, the primary one that I really like is inner bark from dead cottonwood trees, because it's very abundant.
Where you live,
It's very abundant throughout most of the country, actually.
Yeah, I guess throughout the entire country or just the western states?
Oh, for sure the western states.
Yeah,
no, I've seen cottonwoods even in Vermont.
So is that right? I didn't know that.
Yes.
So you get a dead one and you just tell me what you do.
Well, you look for one that's down.
Yeah.
And if it's been down for a year or so, you will see a bunch of strings hanging down underneath it, more than likely. And what that is that's the layer between the bark and the wood, which is we call the cambium layer.
Cambium layer, okay.
And it's very long and stringy. You pull it off in great big long strings.
Okay.
And it will, once you blow on your ember to increase the temperature, it will ignite that cottonwood very easily.
So you take all that fibrous stuff and make it into like a bird nest.
I fluff it up,
get it really fluffy,
yeah. get all the fiber separated, and then I make a rope out of it, sort of like, make it really tight again,
okay,
and tie that little rope into a knot.
Okay.
And then I drop my ember into the middle of that knot.
And you just keep blowing until it gets
and blow on it until it gets hot enough that it will burst into flames.
Now, I heard you guys saying that, that everywhere there's something ideal.
Oh, definitely.
Where you're at, there's cottonwood. Tell me what some of the other tinders are that people need to know about in other parts of the country. What are some of the other things that might be
another
using?
Another good one, this one happens to be in our area also, is juniper bark.
Juniper bark,
From stringy...
We call them shaggy bark junipers.
Yeah, you just peel it off the bark, right?
One seed junipers and Utah junipers have a very shaggy outer bark. You peel it off. It doesn't hurt the tree at all. It sloughs off.
Uh-huh.
You go up to high country, like Flagstaff at 7,000 feet, they have a plant called cliff rose.
Cliff rose, okay.
The bark cliff rose is really, really good. There's a weed called mugwort.
Mugwort,
it's an Artemisian group.
I like
dried
mugwort.
Dried mugwort works really well. Up in Utah, there's a good example. Utah, up into Wyoming and all, the sage bark. Some of those sage plants are 8, 10, 12 feet tall. And the bark off of sage is kind of like the bark off of juniper. You just peel it off, doesn't bother the plant at all, and it fluffs into a very nice, fluffy tinder.
Have you guys used the inner elder bark?
I have, yes.
Yeah, because you know how when that's
I've used the inner bark of screw bean mesquite down in the desert.
Oh, really?
There's the bracken fern. You can't make a nest of it, but you crunch up bracken fern and make a pile of it.
Okay.
It becomes tinder, and put your ember in that, and that'll go into an ember, or into flame quite readily. I've never been a place I could not find tinder.
Yeah, I know that's
very
really
fibrous,
important.
Very fibrous, fluffy material to turn into flame.
Yeah. Okay, and in your...
Pine needles. Okay. Pine needles we consider kindling.
Kindling,
if
right.
If you take pine needles and take two flat rocks and rub them together and turn those pine needles into more fluffy, they make excellent tinder also.
Does it all stay together well when you push it together like a bird nest?
Well, what you do is you just light it as a pile.
Oh, just light it as a pile, okay.
In this case, you would leave it on the ground.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Drop your ember into it and blow into it on the ground.
Okay, yeah. I've not tried that.
And sometimes, it's to make it easier for me, I go to the parking lots around Flagstaff, with the large, like the Museum of Northern Arizona or the large grocery stores that have the ponderosa pines in their area, right at the parking lot.
Yeah.
And you'll find all these pine needles have been driven over by the cars. Oh. It's all crushed and
clever.
Already prepared.
Yeah.
And they just take Safeway bags or, you know, grocery
bags. Collect it,
and
sure.
Just collect it all up, and
yeah.
It makes wonderful tinder, and it smells great too when you're doing it.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah.
Now, you guys demonstrated and talked about a lot of methods. Before I go on to some of the other methods, do you ever I want to just jump back to the hand drill. Do you guys ever recommend using like a foreshaft, an extra piece of wood at the end of the drill for the hand drill, or do you just use?
I have done that. We call that a composite drill.
Composite drill.
Where you take you've got a drill that you say hand drill, for example, and you say this drill is a killer. It's the best.
Yeah.
But sooner or later, it's going to get too short to
correct,
use.
Correct.
Then I take a longer stick and I splice them together.
Okay.
I just take some cordage or some sinew and a little bit of hide glue, and then I splice the two ends together so that I can keep using that stick. That stick might be 6 or 8 inches long, but I can keep hand drilling with it.
Eventually, it's
going to
wear down, of course. Yeah.
And that's called a composite drill.
Okay.
I carry one with me right now, in fact.
Okay.
And it's got about an inch left,
uh-huh.
But it's the best drill in the kit because that wood is one of my best drills ever.
Yeah.
And to give it a longer life, you just tack it on the end of another stick that fits your hands as a drill.
Okay.
That would normally be used for a hand drill because you need a long drill to use with your hands.
Right, right.
And with a strap drill or a bow drill, you can use a fairly short. And the strap drill and the bow drill is much more efficient. You don't have to have as prime material.
Okay.
So you wouldn't necessarily do that for a short bow drill.
But the longer ones you might, yeah.
Correct.
Another area of fire starting that you talked about that might be more widely known to the general public was the flint and steel. But you said something that I had not heard before. There was a rock that has iron in it that you can hit onto flint or quartz and make a spark?
You're talking about iron sulfide, or a pyrite, an iron pyrite. In Europe especially, the Magdalenian culture going back 22,000 years, this was their major, their primary method of starting fire in Europe,
okay.
Northern Europe and in Central Europe.
And what was it
and
exactly?
And marcasite is an
marcasite.
Iron pyrite.
Okay.
It's 40, in its best form, with the least amount of traces of other elements, it's 47% iron and 53% sulfur.
Okay.
And you hit that with a piece of flint, or in this country, a piece of chert.
Okay.
With a sharp edge on it, and you hit a glancing blow, it knocks sparks off of that. Just like the Boy Scouts, and they do their flint and steel off of high carbon steel. It's the same thing, only prehistoric. You're knocking iron sulfur product. You're hitting it at a glancing blow. Sparks come off, and you strike it into something that will catch the spark.
Some ideal tinder.
Catching the spark, there's a variety of fungi that'll work, a whole variety of furs from animals, thistles from plants, downs from birds. I experimented with it, and when I got up to about 20 different things that would work, I quit experimenting because I realized.
Did you put this in the bulletin, Joe?
I wrote an article about this,
interesting.
Too.
Interesting. So it's called marcasite, and
marcasite,
do you
yeah.
get as good of a shower of sparks as you would with modern steel?
No, you don't, but you do get sparks. In fact, I've experimented with lots of methods, and the only method, and I probably shouldn't say this because it might get me someday, but the only method I have never failed at was the marcasite method. I've never had a failure. I mean, I'll hit it maybe 3 or 4 times and no sparks, or the sparks didn't grab, and I'll do it again 3 or 4 times. But I've never walked away saying, well, I just couldn't get one started.
Uh-huh. But the key with this...
And it's an excellent method in high humidity.
Okay.
I've left fungi out on the patio for days under very heavy, wet conditions. I didn't let it get wet, but I left it on the patio under very high, humid conditions, and then ran sparks into it, and the fungus picked those sparks right up and went right into a sustained smolder.
Okay.
It's an excellent method, and I can see why people in Northern Europe went to that at a time when they also had the hand drill. In other words, at those days, 22,000 years ago, they were also using the hand drill in places like modern Sweden today.
Okay.
But the marcasite became the preferred method.
Okay.
And then when the Romans arrived, when their marches up through Northern Europe, they brought flint and steel with them. And it was so easy for Celtic groups, for example, using marcasite, to just all of a sudden go to flint and steel. It was the pre-adaptation of going from one to the other was just a stroke of luck, archaeologically or anthropologically, but it was perfect.
So when did the little C-shaped steel that fits around your fingers come in? That goes way back, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because I recall seeing a picture in a cave in Belgium, I think it was, and they said it went back thousands of years, and it looked like the steel structures we use today, like at the pioneer gatherings.
I believe the Hittites get credit for developing carbon steel probably 1,000 to 1,500 B.C.
Okay.
But before 1 A.D., Romans and other cultures now were also, they learned that high carbon steel in a very brittle form would give a lot of sparks, and they were using it as fire starters.
Okay. And were you demonstrating that the other day? I didn't notice if you were demonstrating.
I don't think we did it. Yes, we did.
Yes, you did.
We did it with a piece of char cloth.
Okay.
And then afterwards, some people came over here and wanted to know if there's anything else that would work, and I took a piece of fungus out of the box, sliced a thin slice off, put it on top of a piece of chert, struck it with the flint, and it lit right up.
Uh-huh. And you teach with the...
Struck it with the iron striker, and it lit right up.
Okay, so basically... that method is, in a sense, essentially the same as using the modern steel and a piece of flint and using char cloth or cattail pollen or whatever.
And of course, flint and steel then becomes the dominant method throughout the world by the first century A.D., and that is our method all the way up into the 1800s.
When matches were invented.
And even the beginning of matches, it wasn't... they were a little bit on the dangerous side. In fact, they were called Lucifers.
I remember hearing that.
And people died.
That's why they were called Lucifers?
They would have them in their suit pockets, and a couple of heads would touch each other and rub and ignite, and the guy couldn't get his clothes off fast enough. And next thing you know, he was on fire.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were kind of dangerous in the very beginning, but because of the chemicals that were used to make them.
So that's a relatively, I think that's a relatively easy method. You were mentioning you need a sharp rock, of course. You can't have a rounded rock.
Mm-hmm.
I see Boy Scouts do it all the time. And you were demonstrating a few other novel methods of making fire, like with batteries. Could you describe that, Mike?
That's a very interesting. We take very fine steel wool, and you need about 3 volts, minimum of about 3 volts. And you hold one end firmly on one end of the battery and tickle the other end of the steel wool to the other end of the battery.
Okay.
And that causes a current to flow in it, which raises the temperature up high enough to rapidly oxidize the iron, and it burns. Rust is a slow oxidation of iron, but this is a rapid self-sustaining oxidation of iron.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive when you see it burning up all of a sudden.
Yeah, it is.
You drop it in a piece of toilet paper, which we have nicknamed tinder paper, and drop it in there and a small breath on it, and next thing you know, you've got a fire.
Yeah.
It's that quick. It's very quick.
Yeah.
So we all carry in our search and rescue unit those little film canisters or little pill bottles.
You don't see the film canisters anymore, do you?
No, so we're gone to the pill bottles, small pill bottles, with steel wool in it, because the metal match will light the steel wool, a magnifier will light it, or the battery. You just take a couple batteries out of your GPS, light the steel wool, and put the batteries back in. The degradation of the batteries, it takes two of the small batteries to get you 3 volts. The degradation is less than 10%.
So in other words, you might be able to do it 10 times when the battery's dead?
I've done it 11 times before I could not do the 12th fire.
11 times with triple A's, which are the smallest we would normally carry.
Really?
I've done 11 fires in a row, and finally the degradation was such where it would not light the 12th time.
So that's actually a real kind of a fun trick for parties.
I mean,
because people don't really realize that steel wool will burn. I've been asked the question, like if your car broke down somewhere and you didn't have steel wool, but you had batteries, are there fine wires in the car that might work? I mean, I've never actually experimented, but are there fine copper wires, for example, that might work?
It would be very dangerous. I would not do it.
It'd be very dangerous. I mean, let's say you were able to pull the wires out of the car and just use...
Well, I wouldn't pull wires out. I would try to find a wire and go from one battery terminal to the other.
On your car battery, you're saying?
On the car battery. And wrap the wire in cloth even if it means take your shirt off, your undershirt.
Yeah.
And it'll light that shirt on fire. It'll light that shirt on fire. But it is sort of a dangerous thing to do. Be a little more intelligent to have a spare lighter in your glove box.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, if we had your jumper cables...
If you use too big of a wire, you could cause a massive explosion of the battery.
Exactly, yeah. What I was actually asking, though, let's say you have a flashlight battery. Mm-hmm. As an alternative, is there an alternative to steel wool to get a fire with... like a D-cell flashlight battery?
There are alternatives. Like, you could use a paper clip, but again, that's very dangerous.
It's very, very dangerous, probably very difficult.
You could blow off the battery.
Yeah, I see. I see. That's very interesting. Okay, so, you know, I think we're just about out of time, you guys, but I really appreciate you spending the time with me. We've covered a lot of methods. How do people find out about what you guys are doing? You just show up at Rabbit Stick and Winter Count and events like Dirt Time?
Yes. Alan Halcon, who's one of the, as you know, one of the supervisors of Dirt Time
right.
here, saw me at a Winter Count a couple years ago.
Okay.
And I showed him the fire saw. He's already a really good hand driller. And I showed him the fire saw and Marcosite and some of the other methods. And he said to me, you really understand fire, all the different methods. Would you come to Dirt Time in Wyoming and talk about them?
Was that your first time at Dirt Time, was Wyoming?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But when he talked to me, I talked a little bit about the anthropology yeah. behind these methods.
Yeah.
Especially the prehistoric methods and when they came to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of myths or a lot of misconceptions. Like people say, the bow drill's not prehistoric. The bow drill is prehistoric. When you see the Anasazi using it, 1100 AD, in Anasazi country, that's prehistoric. It
yeah.
might not have been prehistoric in Roman times right. or Italy, but 1100 AD was prehistoric in the New World.
Right.
And the Anasazi were using the bow drill by then. And of course, it was being used already in Mesoamerica and was a very dominant fire-making method when Cortez arrives in the Valley of Mexico in 1519.
That was, you're speaking of the bow drill.
The bow drill, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it had already been developed and diffused around the New World.
Uh-huh.
Alan liked the idea that I had done some research in all of these methods and I could talk about where they existed. For example, Australia.
Yeah.
The hand drill is the only method that has been found on every continent in the world that was inhabited.
In Australia,
it was the outer ring of Australia, the cultures used it there. But you could penetrate to the interior of Australia, you now start running into fire plow cultures and fire sawing cultures. And so, but it's that kind of information, that kind of background that I would talk about, and Alan liked that.
Yeah, well,
so
it definitely
Alan was more interested that I explain the anthropology behind it besides how to do it.
Right.
Where and that's how he kind of got me to go to Wyoming first, and then now we're here this week at this Dirt Time here
yeah.
in California.
Yeah, I mean, Alan is really fast and good at it, and
mm-hmm.
he knows the hand drill and the bow drill, but you guys add like a certain depth to know that everybody in the world has always been fascinated
mm-hmm.
with fire and needed fire and had needed all kind of methods to do it. So people can... read about you guys, read about your work and the Bulletin of Primitive Technology. If anybody wanted to contact either of you, my website is right there on the computer, and they can contact
okay.
me,
yeah,
or I'll contact Al
or
Mike.
Uh-huh.
So thank you for speaking with us tonight,
You're very
Mike.
Welcome. It was a pleasure.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was very interesting.
Al, all right.
Okay. And we'll see you tomorrow for the strap drill.
Very good.